American poetry of the second half of the 19th century and of the beginning of the 20th century. The basic distinguishing feature of American poetry of the second half of the 19th century is its romanticist ideological framework, if we may call it that. The key concepts promoted or embraced by the romanticists were strong-willed individualism, spiritual and aesthetic dimension of nature, and originality in both form and content. These were also the topics which we can find in the poetry of Walt Whitman, arguably the most important and possibly most original American poet of the 19th century. His originality didn't only reside in the topics he chose to write about, because unlike traditionalists, like traditional poets, he chose to write in free verse, which means the lines of his poetry didn't or do not rhyme. So let us start with this basic formal distinction in 19th century American poetry. The traditionalist camp would consist of people who were roughly the same generation as Whitman, and the most respectable and popular among these were so-called fireside poets. Fireside referred to the fact that they were very popular with the reading public, which is something that was not necessarily true about Whitman. It was essentially the first group of poets that was as popular in America as British poets of that time, namely Tennyson. I will be a bit selective now, and I'll only mention two poets of this group whom I consider to be rather important, though they come from extremely different backgrounds. These two poets are Longfellow and Whittier. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is perhaps best known for his poem Song of Hiawatha, in which he celebrates the American wilderness while also lamenting and the vanishing beauty of the Native American culture. In a way, he was essentially trying to take European pastoral and nature-inspired romanticist tradition, which he knew quite well, and implant it to a very different American environment. You know, it's sometimes reminiscent of the British lake poets in choice of topics. So let's listen to a brief example of the prologue to Hiawatha to see what kind of poetry resulted from this attitude. The irony is that the prologue, or prelude, to the Song of Hiawatha actually uses rather irregular rhyming, unlike many of his other poems, which are very regular.
Should you ask me whence these stories, whence these legends and traditions, with the odors of the forest, with the dew and damp of meadows, with the curling smoke of wigwams, with the rushing of great rivers, with their frequent repetitions and their wild reverberations, as of thunder in the mountains, I should answer, I should tell you, from the forests and the prairies, from the great lakes of the Northland, from the land of the Ojibways, from the land of the Dakotas, from the mountains, moors, and fenlands, where the heron, the shushuga, feeds among the reeds and rushes. I repeat them as I heard them, from the lips of Nawadaha, the musician, the sweet singer. Should you ask where Nawadaha found these songs so wild and wayward, found these legends and traditions, I should answer, I should tell you, in the birds' nests of the forest, in the lodges of the beaver, in the hoofprint of the bison, in the eyrie of the eagle. All the wild fowl sang them to him, in the moorlands and the fenlands, in the melancholy marshes.
John Greenleaf Whittier was generally regarded as a slave poet, which does not mean that he was a slave himself. No, he was a Quaker, and as such advocated the abolition of slavery in his speeches, writings, and perhaps most eloquently in his poems. He writes very lucid, very clear poetry, which has often been compared to the Scottish pre-romantic poet Robert Burns. As I said, both of these poets used traditional rhyming, in sharp contrast with the first American free-versing poet, a free-verser, Walt Whitman. No rhyming obviously has its advantages in terms of how much you can express, but even that is a topic for debate. I personally do not find it very liberating to write unrhymed poetry. I guess it's an issue of personal preference. In any case, Whitman was a free-verser, and this unchained form of artistic expression closely corresponded with his willful individualism and freedom-loving disposition, including the openness about homosexuality. This individualistic message is perhaps best expressed in his poem Song of Myself, which came out in his first and most critically acclaimed collection of poems, Leaves of Grass, which came out in 1855.
I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same, and their parents the same. I, now 37 years old, in perfect health begin, hoping to cease not till death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check, with original energy. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself.
The major female poet of this time, Emily Dickinson, shared Whitman's radical individualism in her own way, but she didn't share his enthusiasm for free verse. However, she didn't use standard traditional rhyming either. Perhaps the most easily identifiable feature of her poetry in formal terms is a so-called slant rhyme or approximate rhyme. Let's demonstrate this on one of her poems called The Soul Selects Her Own Society.
The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door. On her divine majority obtrude no more. Unmoved, she notes the chariots pausing at her low gate. Unmoved, an emperor is kneeling upon her mat. I've known her from an ample nation choose one, then close the valves of her attention like stone.
As you can see, there's one approximate rhyme in the first stanza, society, majority, then gate and mat in the second stanza, and then in the last stanza you've got one and stone, which is a typical I rhyme. That's also type of slant rhyme. I rhyme, which means visually it's the same. Her poetic style is extremely sketchy and brief. We might almost say compressed. Catherine Van Spankeren puts it in the following way. She never uses two words when one will do. So it's extremely sparse. One critic once wrote that Dickinson's poetry sometimes felt as if a cat came at us speaking English, meaning very, very abrupt. And in fact, Dickinson was not discovered and fully appreciated until the 1950s, more than half a century after she died. The four authors I have mentioned so far are obviously not the only noteworthy poets of the late 19th century. In fact, even the hardcore transcendentalists Emerson and Thoreau, who are generally celebrated for their essays and prose writing in general, also managed to write some very interesting poetry. Emerson happens to be particularly close to my heart. The last major poet who can be loosely subsumed under the category of late 19th century and early 20th century poetry is Carl Sandburg. Though he's very far away from the romanticist sentiments I've been describing so far, he's perhaps most famous for his poem Chicago and his biography of Abraham Lincoln, for which he received a Pulitzer Prize.